And throughout the course of this third Chinese Revolution, the Communist Party, led by Mao Zedong now, imposed various arbitrary restrictions and limits upon its course. It was a deformed revolution, and we should keep that in mind. It was arbitrarily controlled within certain limits by the Communist Party. The agrarian reform, for instance, was carried out in stages, and it wasn't completed until American imperialism intervened in Korea and started the Korean intervention. And it's by these arbitrary restraints and controls that Mao was able to control and deform the revolution. As much as possible, they tried to restrict the struggle to the military plane. That was true especially in the beginning, in the struggle with the Chiang Kai-shek forces from 47 on. And this was primarily to restrict, as much as possible, the struggle to the countryside and to prevent the Chinese workers from emerging on the arena as an independent force. Because the Chinese workers and students did emerge as an independent force after the defeat of the Japanese imperialists. There were tremendous upsurges in the coastal cities of China. And if at that point, I'm talking now about 45, 46, the Chinese Communist Party had changed its policy and called for the overthrow of the Kuomintang and coordinated its struggle on the countryside with that of the mass upsurges taking place in the cities, the Chinese Revolution could have been completed much quicker in a series of mass struggles at the end of 45 and 46. Instead, they were still prolonging their coalition with Chiang Kai-shek and allowed Chiang Kai-shek to crush the workers and the students in the cities in 45 and 46. And it was in this way that they deformed the process of the Chinese Revolution, the third one, consciously, so to speak, by letting the students and the workers be defeated by the Kuomintang and then restricting the struggle to the military plane when they did change their policy. Not that this policy that they had was thought out, but that was their natural reaction, first of all, to the policy of coalition and subordination to Chiang Kai-shek that they had in line with Stalin's peaceful coexistence policy elaborated at Yalta and elsewhere with the imperialists. And then they sort of stumbled into power despite their program, forced into it on the one hand by Chiang Kai-shek, who began this general assault on them, and they decided to defend themselves. After months and months of hesitation what policy to pursue, they finally did decide that survival was necessary. In that sense, in this ability of the bureaucratic leadership to retard the struggle, to deform it, and to bring the victory into question, so to speak, again and again, even when it was within their grasp, that we characterize them as a variety of Stalinism. And see, what do I mean by that? First of all, I tried to point out how their road to power was very tortuous, that their program is full of opportunist and Menshevik conceptions inherited from Stalin. And the actions that they carried out were hesitating, empirical, contradictory. And the non-capitalist tasks were actually forced on them, as we shall see, by the Korean War, the intervention of the American imperialists. So you might say, when they did gain the power in 1949, it was not because of their policies, but despite of them. That's a very crucial distinction to make. It was due to exceptionally favorable circumstances. Internally, the Kuomintang regime simply collapsed. Chiang Kai-shek was a nudnik in economic matters, to coin a phrase, or no goodnik, or ignoramus, perhaps is a better word. He didn't understand economics. There was a runaway inflation, and his own advisors told him it had to be stopped and something had to be done. But he was a militarist, and he, like Mao, believed that power comes out of the barrel of a gun. As long as they had the army, didn't matter how the inflation raged. And in the end, his regime just simply collapsed with this runaway inflation. There was a fact that Japanese imperialism was defeated in World War II. Nothing that the Chinese did that. It's just that they were defeated in the inter-imperialist struggle, and that factor was removed. And the fact that American imperialism wasn't able to fill this vacuum that was left by Japanese imperialism, for the good reason that the American troops wanted to go home, they were tired of fighting, and they refused to be sent to the Far East. I know because I was in Europe agitating to go home, and my division was scheduled to be sent to the Far East. Well, we really started to scream at that point, and at that point, that's what initiated the big demonstrations in Europe, where 10,000 men of the division demonstrated in front of the division headquarters, "We want to go home." At which point the general said, "The planes are on the way, just hold it, don't go away." And they saluted us. That was the best part of it. It's the first time I've ever been saluted by a general. At any rate, the American imperialists were not able to intervene into China for the reasons of the unwillingness of the American GI to carry on another war in the Far East. You might call it the general weakening of world imperialism. There were tremendous strike waves in the United States at the time. And then there was the Marshall Plan and the intervention in Eastern Europe, where the American imperialists tried to break the bloc they had, or the division of the world that they had established with Stalin, where they had given him Eastern Europe at his sphere of influence. They tried to take it back, and in defense, just like the Maoists did in China, in defense, he began to transform the proper relations in Eastern Europe to get a better hold of them, in a bureaucratic military manner too. So these exceptional circumstances just sort of flowed together at this particular conjuncture in time and allowed them to come to power. And you might say it sort of fell into their lap despite their policy. And that's one of the hardest things to understand, that it was not because of their policies, but despite. Since coming to power, they have continued this policy of empiric zigzag, of opportunist and adventurist policies carried out one after the other at the same time in a curious admixture. And you know, when I characterize them as a variety of Stalinism, I'm not just using a slander word or something, because they consciously admire Stalin, and Mao always did and still does to this day. And that's where his program comes from. That's also where he gets the idea of this uncontrolled, undemocratic, dictatorial rule over the masses of China, together with the cult and the adulation and everything else that goes with the cultism that was started by Stalin. And in that sense, too, the Communist Party of China constitutes, like the bureaucrats in the Soviet Union, a privileged bureaucracy that is oriented towards building socialism in one country, that is essentially nationalistic in its approach rather than being motivated by the international socialist revolution and its goal. Now, coming to power, they established a coalition government, the so-called New Democracy, which was that same old block of four classes elevated to power now. They conciliated with the kulaks and the ex-Kuomintang officials, whom they even incorporated officially into the people's government that was established. And it wasn't until 1950, with the intervention of American imperialism, that they hesitatingly, and again being forced by the rise in the internal counter-revolution that intervention of American imperialism provoked, to complete the land reform in the south of China and to purge the state apparatus completely, or more or less, so to speak, of the Kuomintang elements that were essentially counter-revolutionary, non-revolutionary. And again, they did this by means of mass mobilizations and show trials and mass executions, but again, strictly controlled, strictly bureaucratically controlled and handled. And they didn't go over to any kind of socialist tasks until 1953. And they didn't begin collectivizations, which they did in the typical Stalinist manner, in a forced, compulsory way, till 1954, and then later on, and there were disputes between Mao and Liu Shaoqi about how long it would take, with Mao saying it should be completed in 2-3 years, and Liu Shaoqi saying it should be completed in a longer time, but, you know, still in a compulsory fashion. Then in 1958 came the Great Leap Forward into communism, supposedly. The struggle to surpass Great Britain in industrial production, the whole business with the backyard furnaces, communal kitchens, the five togethers. I'll go into that in a little while, which was another big adventurous leap forward, which resulted in great natural disasters, which weren't natural but were provoked by the regime and by its previous policy. At which point Liu Shaoqi, we found out later, didn't know at the time, pushed Mao Zedong a little bit off the central leadership and sort of moderated the course that had been followed previously. And a retreat took place towards establishing some more sane relations in agriculture. Only this was to be followed very quickly, 1965 to 69, by the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution, or another tremendous upheaval with the Red Guards called into being, which actually turned out to be only to be for Mao's factional purposes. That was followed by the calling off of the Great Cultural Proletarian Revolution, the purging of Lin Piao, the anti-Confucius campaign, and just recently concluded now in January, the Fourth National People's Congress, which adopted a new constitution. But it's interesting just how that National People's Congress was arranged and how it functions. And this is the latest instance, so I just want to tell you how it was arranged. They met secretly. The Chinese people weren't even informed that it was meeting until after it had met. That was the official governmental body that supposedly rules China, met secretly, then the people were informed it had met and informed of their decisions. There was no pretense of public discussion of the new constitution. The first time anybody heard of it in China was after it had been adopted. And the delegates to the National People's Congress, there's close to 3,000 of them, they only got the resolution of the constitution 8 days before the opening of the Congress. And the constitution itself goes considerably further than even Stalin's constitution of 1935 in codifying the substitution of the party for the state, of the party leadership for the party as a whole, and of the individual dictator for even the collective leadership of the party, or the collective party leadership, rather. Article 16, for instance, says, "The National People's Congress is the highest organ of state power under the leadership of the Communist Party of China," unquote. In other words, there's no question of any other parties or anything like that. And they abolished the post of the head of state. That's because Liu Shaoqi, you know, had come into conflict with the head of party, so they just abolished that post formally. And Article 15 says, "The chairman of the Central Committee of the Communist Party commands the country's armed forces." Any questions on that, you see? That makes him a very powerful figure, as you can see. Not the government, the official government commands the armed forces, but the party chairman of a political party, commands the armed forces of a state. Then the fundamental rights and duties of the citizen are defined as follows. They are to support the leadership of the Communist Party of China. That's in the Constitution. That's like saying the Constitution, you have to support the policies of the leadership of the Republican National Committee head. That's in the Constitution, you know, that kind of a thing. In other words, to disagree with the Maoist leadership means to disagree with the Constitution of China. And the Mao cult is written into the preamble of the Constitution that says, our great motherland will always advance along the road indicated by Marxism, Leninism, Mao Zedong's thought. And then Stalin's theory of building socialism in one country and peaceful coexistence with imperialism, along with this cult of Mao Zedong's thought, is also written into the preamble of the Constitution. So you get an idea, you know, how they function right at this point. But the zigzag policies that they have followed in power, this alternation of opportunism with adventurism and sectarianism, is typical of these kind of formations that can be characterized as D-class petty bourgeois formations that find themselves at the head of non-capitalist countries, as Maoism is and as the Russian bureaucrats are. When they came to power, they had to do everything against their program in order to stay in power. They wanted to construct a capitalist economy, but three-quarters of the economy had to be nationalized because they were owned by Chiang Kai-shek and his clique, and it just, they had to take it over. There's nobody else to administer it. So it sort of was nationalized despite their program. They wished to avoid a struggle against the national bourgeoisie, against Chiang Kai-shek, and they were forced into that by Chiang Kai-shek. They wanted to avoid any kind of planning, but they had to plan anyway because of the enormity of the problems that they faced. And as I indicated, they wanted to conciliate with the rich peasants, but they had to fight them anyway because the poor peasants revolted. Well, anything goes like that, from one to the other. In each case, they follow a policy that turns out to be unrealistic, and they have to do the opposite almost against their own will. And then when they do carry out that policy, they go to such extremes that it provokes further problems, then they have to make another turn back, and they veer in this manner, in a zigzag fashion, from one end of an incorrect policy to the other end of the zigzag incorrect policy. And in the process, you know, even some of the things now that are contained in Mao's selected works, this whole theory of the new democracy that they're going to build after they take power, sort of passes into limbo. And in 1953, they all of a sudden begin to speak about China having already entered the road of socialism. They begin to make the turn towards nationalization, planning, and collectivization. Now, it so happened that 1953 was also the year that Stalin died, that uprisings took place in eastern Germany. Not too long after that, in 1956, there was the Hungarian uprising, and the Polish events took place, tremendous struggles by the workers of these Eastern European people's democracy to do away with the bureaucratic regime and establish democratic socialist regime. And of course, then the Russians intervened into Hungary and crushed the Russian Revolution there, and the demand for workers' democracy was crushed. But after that, Khrushchev let slip out some of the crimes of Stalin and began to denounce Stalin, sort of trying to blame all the bad things on Stalin now. And Mao Zedong also was forced by the pressure of these events to sort of give way to moderate his personal dictatorship. And in the aftermath of Khrushchev's speech to the 20th Congress, some of the things were loosened up inside China. Mao Zedong even gave a speech that it was all right for the workers and in production to criticize the administrators, that is the bureaucrats, that contradictions within the people exist even after the taking of power by the Communist Party. And although he played with that idea, he was always pro-Stalin in the sense that he basically wished to maintain the bureaucratic regime and gave way before the demands of democracy internationally, and to some extent in China, only very grudgingly. There was a blossom and contend experience. For a very short period, in 1957, they allowed sort of everyone should speak up and criticize the regime and the government and see what they have to say. Let 100 blossoms bloom and 100 schools, 100, something like that, 100 schools of thought contend. And such a storm of criticism arose in China that they very quickly clamped their lid on again. And they began to slander those that had criticized the regime before. And shortly after this, and instead they slandered all the left-wing critics as being right-wingers. Right after that, after this repression against the so-called rightists, who were really leftists, calling for democratic rights, the adventurous turn was taken towards the communes and the surpassed Great Britain in steel production movement. Again, this was arbitrarily introduced very quickly. In something like 2 months, all of the cooperatives that had been established previously were amalgamated into communes, without, however, the technological wherewithal to allow them to function on a higher technological plane. And this, of course, violates all the tenets of Marxist approach to how agriculture should be collectivized after the victory of the proletariat. Lenin and Engels, who wrote on these subjects, especially Lenin, explained very carefully that it has to be voluntary, that the peasants have to be convinced by example that they stand to gain and benefit economically when they join a collective or a cooperative. But they, of course, followed Stalin's course of doing all this in a compulsory fashion, forcing people into that, and it provoked a catastrophe on the countryside. And like Stalinists always do, and especially the Maoists do, they embellished this commune program and this great leap forward into socialism by what can only be called sloganeering, Madison Avenue type sloganeering, false promises, putting things in such a light that made them actually ludicrous after they found out, the peasants found out what it actually involved. It involved the forcible militarization of the life on the countryside. They had the five togethers. You eat together, you live to work together, you work together, you study together, and you play together. In other words, they broke up family life completely and substituted instead this complete communalization, where you eat in the community kitchen, you sleep in dormitories, you work together in the field, you study together, etc. and so forth, allowing breaking up and melting down the pots and pans of the family, without, however, substituting for that family life some higher developed form of providing food or shelter. In other words, it meant a lower standard of living for everyone. And the women, rather than being liberated from the slavery of the family household, were driven into the slavery of a collective or a communal household, which isn't an improvement, but turned out to be a deterioration, where they're now working 17 hours in the field, plus having to work in the communal kitchens and so forth and so on. All of this under the heading of building communism. And their backyard furnaces that were going to outproduce Great Britain in steel production, of course, turned out inferior steel. And there was one priceless description of some, I think it was a capitalist reporter, that visited the big cooperative factory for a whole province that was breaking all records, making steel ball bearings. And they had a big sign over that this is such and such province steel ball bearing plant, breaking all production records. And when he came to that place, it was a group of women sitting in a circle with little hammers pounding kitchen implements into little balls. You know, that kind of a thing. Which, of course, are not steel ball bearings, which is beside the point. And this, and also, you know, for establishing the equality of women, that was one of the slogans. And it did nothing of the kind, and really meant that they were exploited to the maximum, just as the men were. And from domestic slavery, they went to coolie-type labor in the fields and in the commune. And they operated all of this along military lines, where people were now organized not in family units, but in battalions and regiments and divisions. And you know, each one had a commander who organized the struggle along military lines against nature, so-called. No job changes were allowed. Everybody was, you know, in these regiments and brigades and companies that were engaged in the fight and production. And it separated wives and husbands and children and so forth. And they lived the collective way and they worked as if fighting a battle. So it merely turned out to be a more effective instrument for a time for exploiting and increasing the exploitation of the peasantry, which very quickly found out, although they might have joined willingly at first, it sounded good, you know, that you're going to eat in the communal kitchen and get better food. Well, why would we cook at home? When it turns out that the food is no good and it's sparse, that the housing is terrible, that you have no privacy, that you work harder, that you have no time for your own leisure or anything like that, they very quickly turned around and began to slow down, not work as hard, and generally production dropped in the end after they found out what it was like. Well, after the harvest turned down and after the production dropped on the countryside, they had to change the policy. Liu Shaoqi stepped in, as I said, sort of pushed Mao Zedong into the background and advocated a more prudent policy than advocated Mao Zedong and managed to get the country back on a more even keel. At the same time, the Sino-Soviet split and dispute broke out at the same time that this communization policy was taking place. And this, of course, provoked problems as well. And it led eventually, all of these problems led then to the great so-called proletarian cultural revolution. Again, this is a contradiction in term. Trotsky, in his view, conceived that there would be no such thing as a proletarian culture in the transition stage. But by the time you had socialism, there would be no proletariat. Therefore, there would be no time for the proletariat as a ruling class to develop a culture of its own. That this would really be merely a transitional period where you still had bourgeois culture before you went into socialist culture. But these were merely demagogic slogans issued by Mao, who posed as an anti-bureaucratic fighter, who unleashed the most immature and the youngest of the student population, who generally turned out to be not university students or even high school students, but on the lower level than that, which he could manipulate more easily, mobilize them by the millions, and displace Liu Shaoqi and his forces from the control of the party leadership. Then when things started to get out of hand, when some of the demagogic demands that were, or slogans that were issued by the Maoist leadership to the Red Guards against the bureaucrats, so-called in the party leadership, against the capitalist roaders, as they were termed, the renegades and any agents that they were called eventually, Finally, the workers got into the act in Shanghai in 1967 and 66, the end of 66 and 67. And parts of the peasantry became aroused too, and mass mobilizations took place, you know, among the peasants on the countryside as well as the workers in Shanghai. It's at this point that Mao called upon the army under Lin Piao to disarm and disperse the Red Guards, send them all to the countryside, get them out of the cities, and to once more put a lid on the workers, and especially the intellectuals, as well as the peasants, once he had gained leadership back in the party again and displaced Liu Shaoqi from power. And the Cultural Revolution, so-called, is thus another example of how Mao maneuvers to impose his personal leadership on the rest of the party. Matter of fact, he went completely outside the party, mobilized a section of the population, and used that to displace those that had displaced him from power somewhat and step back into the central leadership. And in the process, he broke up, you know, the central core of the old Maoist team that had fought together for a long, long time in the process as well. And the cult of Maoism, you know, rose to new heights during the Great Cultural Revolution. It seems incredible now, unless you look through the old issues of the Maoist press, precisely what they were saying at the time. Let me just give you some examples. The brilliance of Mao Zedong's thought illuminates the whole world. Mao Zedong is the greatest genius of all time. Now, these kind of things you could read all the time in the Maoist press. Mao Zedong's thought gives wisdom, strength, courage, confidence to all people. Mao Zedong is the never-setting sun. Mao Zedong is the great helmsman of the revolution. Mao Zedong is the telescope and the microscope and the radiant sun combined. Mao Zedong's thought prevents drowning. Mao Zedong... I like a proof of that. Somebody volunteer? Mao Zedong's thought gets the mail delivered on time. Mao Zedong's thought cures sunburn. Mao Zedong's thought... I'm not making this up. Mao Zedong's thought keeps food cold without refrigeration. Mao Zedong's thought produces petroleum. Mao Zedong's thought reaps bumper harvest despite drought. It cures deaf mutes. It makes chicken feathers ascend to heaven. That must be some Chinese, part of Chinese culture. I don't know about what that means. Somebody invented a drilling machine that lighted up like a pinball machine every 15 minutes, and a picture of Mao popped up, and it played the Maoist anthem, "East, the East is Red," and also shouts, "Long live Chairman Mao." Imagine working on a machine like that for 15 minutes. Every 15 minutes, duck. Well, not too long after all that, 8 million of these former Red Guards were sent to the countryside together with the professors and the students, and a number of people were killed in the process, the professors and the party leaders, in that, you know, the height of the madness of the Cultural Revolution. Then Lin Piao, who at the 9th Congress of the Communist Party in April of 1969 had been designated as Mao Zedong's heir and successor, was displaced from power in September of 1971. And after the fall of Lin Piao, the army and its generals have been whittled away at in their power ever since then. The most dramatic move came in January of last year, when the senior military commanders of the various regions of China were transferred from their traditional regional commands and organizational bases to different regions, Well, you know, that doesn't sound like much to us here, but the various dialects and languages of China, you know, while the written language is the same, the dialects spoken in different parts of the country are different. And some of the dialect speakers can't understand each other, and they sent some generals who spoke, say, Cantonese to another part of the country where he couldn't even talk the language and nobody understood what he was saying, and vice versa. Although, you know, they managed to make themselves understood. If nothing else, they'd have to resort to writing. And the transfer of these men to new regions, the cutting off of the old clique ties, reduced the ability of the army or a sector of it to claim, you know, their due after the fall of Lin Piao. Now again, Mao established his own exclusive control, breaking the bloc with Lin Piao and the army. And then the criticized Lin Piao and Confucius campaign began only a few weeks after that. And the slogan was issued, criticize Lin Piao and other swindlers. And that leaves a big opening for who the other swindlers are going to be. And the most prominent targets of the anti-Confucius campaign, of course, are the millions of educated youth and intellectuals that were deported to the countryside at the end of the Cultural Revolution. The need to silence them and to keep them on the countryside, that's why they chose Confucius, who's the prototype of a typical Chinese intellectual, as a symbol against this campaign. And the number of people sent to the countryside is not small. They were, after all, most of the students in the country of the period. They were organized in the Red Guard. There's something like, the Maoist press itself estimates it at 8 million, and sometimes in the last period they have said 10 million. Well, together with their relatives, that's a sizable force. Everybody in China has lots of relatives. So 8 million, say 4 or 5 relatives for each, although they're probably larger, that's a sizable force. They might come to 50, 60, and everybody would know somebody that had been deported and so forth. The idea was officially to re-educate them through manual labor, but now the Maoist press makes hardly any effort at all to show that this was a punitive sending, exile, and a repressive function of these deportations. And no claim is made that they have been re-educated, that they can return to the city at all. On the contrary, the anti-Confucius campaign made the point that they were still a danger and to the regime, a threat of capitalist restoration, that they had to stay in the countryside for an indefinite period. Now, in all of these zigzag policies and purges and clique struggles that I tried to enumerate, just sort of skimmed over, really, Mao has succeeded in eliminating virtually all the old leaders of the Communist Party who participated in the Long March or the Civil War against Chiang Kai-shek or the founding of the People's Republic. Some of them are reportedly dead, like Lin Piao. Others, you don't even know what happened to them, such as Liu Shaoqi, although there's some rumors that he's somewhere on a commune in the countryside. On the other hand, Mao Zedong is not getting any younger. He happens to be 81 at this point. So the problem of succession comes in, and I think that was the main purpose of the Fourth People's Congress, to sort of tighten and cinch things up so that nothing would break out in case Mao dies. Now, Stalin filled his administration after he had gotten rid of all of the old revolutionaries of Lenin's time with relatively unknowns, matter of fact, with former opponents who had capitulated and humbled themselves before him, thus destroying any authority that they would have to step into his place. And Mao has done similar things. The new leadership has three component elements. There's the real ancients, people that are real, even older than Mao, such as Chu De, you know, who goes way back to the Qing Fan Shan. I think he's probably in his 90s by now, no pretense to taking over from Mao or anything like that. or in his late 80s. Then the younger functionaries who owe their rise to the in the hierarchy to the readiness to follow orders from Mao. There's people like Wang Hongwen, Li Tishan, and so on. And then rehabilitated captives from the Liu Shaoqi camp who have humbled themselves and sort of discredited before the masses of China and couldn't possibly aspire to take over his mantle. Teng Xiaoping is one of those, who was the former Communist Party General Secretary under Liu Shaoqi and who was criticized in the Proletarian Revolution, who's now, I think, one of the vice president. If they still have that title, I don't know. And again, besides being aimed at the intellectual dissenters and the people that are sent into exile into the countryside, the anti-Confucius campaign has also been used by the regime to promote stepped up production in industry and in the countryside. And again, it's a battle for getting more production out of the workers. And there's an article that appeared, as a matter of fact, yesterday in the Los Angeles Times, which is actually from the Agence France-Presse by René Flippot. And the headline is, Chinese workers brag of no raises. Peking points with pride to groups that have yielded bourgeois rights, such as asking for higher wages. Ting Ken Tsai, factory worker in China's largest tractor plant at Luoyang, likes to boast that he has not had a single pay raise in 20 years. From 1955 to 75, he has always earned about $62 a month. He claims he is not only happy at this total lack of any promotion during this period, but that he has also refused to accept any additional payments for overtime he has worked. Well, I won't go into the detail. It is clear that this is a bourgeois right and that he has renounced it and he doesn't need any more wages. The same kind of thing goes, this is called the campaign against bourgeois rights. Wang Huixiong, vice president of the Revolutionary Committee of Hunan Province, gave journalists another example of the fight against bourgeois rights in the agricultural domain. He said that one of the production brigades in the Qi Li Ying commune donated to the state 1 year's bonus in cash they had earned. The state had paid the bonus because the brigade had harvested a larger cereal crop than estimated in its annual quota. So you see, you know, what the final aim of all these is. It simply allows the state to appropriate a larger surplus product under the regime. And also means that dissenters who try to disagree with this are immediately put down and denounced as capitalist rotors advocating bourgeois rights and so forth. Obviously, another move to buttress the bureaucratic regime and to throttle any kind of democratic strivings in China. Now, you come to the modern era in China now, the present day, and it's true, and this was the visitor's note, that there have been tremendous steps made forward from what existed prior to the revolution. And as a matter of fact, in the two decades since the establishment of a planned economy in China, the economic institutions of a workers' state, even under bureaucratic rule, have shown their superiority over those of the declining and decaying capitalist order of things. And there can be no dispute about that, and we support those achievements. But it is also true that on the road forward, this bureaucratic totalitarianism of the Maoist China is the very antithesis of a society on the road to socialism. That this bureaucratic rule at every step weakens and undermines the Chinese revolution at every turn. If nothing else, you know, any serious worker in the West that reads these kind of communications that come from China, no wage raises, the adulation of Mao Zedong and so forth, can only be repelled, as well as the lack of democracy. And in that sense, the bureaucratic regime stifles, you know, the advance of the world revolution elsewhere. And the privileged bureaucracy clings to power only through these destructive and repugnant assaults on the most fundamental prerequisite of what actually a socialist society should be. That is, to the aspects of workers' democracy, of a rising standard of living, a flowering of culture, not a denunciation of intellectuals or of dissenters. And of course, proletarian internationalism, of really supporting struggles of oppressed peoples in other sections of the world. And we, of course, side unequivocally with the students and the workers and the peasants of China in this battle for socialist democracy. And the employment of violence and of terror and of repression by Mao to preserve the privileges and the power of his regime against the working masses, to us shows only that these aims cannot be achieved by reforms, but only through real, genuine mass upheavals that will sweep away all this Stalinist claptrap and this Maoist apparatus, and then begin to vest the real power in the worker state in democratically elected councils of workers, of peasants, and of students.
Okay, I just have two short announcements before we can go into discussion. I'm sure people have a lot of questions. The first one is...
There were Koreans and people from Manchuria that participated in the fight against the American intervention in Korea and in the Chinese Revolution. What effect that has had? If you ask me what role the national question played in the Chinese Revolution, I can elaborate on that. The people in Manchuria are not Chinese, they're Manchus. And Manchu is not Chinese as I know it. I'm not that expert on the question. And Korean is not considered Chinese, although they're all languages of a, you know, bigger group in which they're all included. I think it's called the Tibetan Burmese general group of languages. They're related, but they're not the same language. But on the national question as such, on the long march and incorporated into the program of the Chinese Communist Party in the 20s and in the struggle for power, there was always the call for greater rights for oppressed nationalities, for self-determination. And in some ways, they had to have this in this program to be able even to complete the Long March. If you read the story of the Long March, their route took them precisely on the outskirts and in the hinterland through all the national minorities, the Muslims that live in Sikyong and towards the Gobi Desert. And they had to have friend relations with them in order to be able to pass through the territory. Not all of them were willing to give them that. But the national question in China, in other words, the question of national minorities, does exist, but only to a very peripheral extent. It's not a crucial question like it is in other countries, in the sense that the bulk of this tremendous, you know, 500 or 800 million population, the overwhelming majority of them consider themselves Chinese. And the oppressed minorities, or what used to be oppressed minorities, are a very small minority. Officially, the Maoists have the same kind of attitude towards them that the Soviet Union has. They formally grant them autonomy, but they actually oppress them. In other words, they don't grant them the right of self-determination, of seceding, or of separatism, or anything like that. They're administered bureaucratically, but they pay lip service to their right of more autonomy, cultural autonomy. And at all the celebration, there'll be dances of the various cultural minorities. And officially, you know, I mean, formalistically, they have, you know, all the rights they're supposed to have, but really they don't. You know, in actuality they don't.
What happened to the Trotskyists during the Third Chinese Revolution, and also as related to that, what became of the remnants of the whole Low Ruby that you mentioned in the last lecture? Were there any remnants of what became of them? And they seem to be the representatives of the trade unions, etc.
Yeah. Well, they disappeared in the 30s, the Hull and Low forces. They existed, they had branches for a period of time in various cities, but then, you know, they were under crossfire by the Communist Party, by the Japanese, you know, by the various imperialist occupation forces, and by and large, eventually, they disappeared in the late 30s. The Trotskyists formed their own organization in the early 30s, 1931 or 32, their leaders, Chen Duxiu and Peng Shuce, were put on trial for 2 years by Chiang Kai-shek and got a prison sentence. I think it was 15 years or something like that. But the jail that they were put in was bombed after 5 years by the Japanese, and they were released after that. I guess the jail just was bombed to smithereens and the prisoners had to be released, something like that. Then, when the Japanese occupied that section of China in which the Trotskyists were active, which were the coastal cities, you know, where the urban concentrations were, and the Trotskyists had a working class orientation, they had to go underground and were persecuted by the Japanese, although they did manage to keep their organization together and keep functioning even under the Japanese and print. And some of them joined the resistance forces against the Japanese. Some of them forced joined the various Red Army units that were formed. Well, of course, as soon as they were found out, the Maoists would execute them or get rid of them in some way, or engineered in such a way that the units that they led were cut to pieces by the Japanese or the Kuomintang. In other words, would betray them and so forth. Very difficult situation to function under, where you're under fire from all sources, you know, from the Communist Party forces, from the Kuomintang forces, and from the Japanese forces. Very difficult situation for a small organization to function under those conditions. After the fall of Japanese imperialism, when this working class upsurge and student upsurge took place in the cities of China, the Trotskyist movement began to grow very rapidly and constituted a sizable force. They had a national convention of something like 400 to 500 people about a year or so after the fall of the Japanese. And they constituted a viable force, except again, the Maoists had the policy of letting the Kuomintang repress the workers in the cities, and at that point they underwent, you know, the repression by the Kuomintang and lost some forces, but they kept themselves together. Then when it was clear that the Chinese Communist Party under Mao's leadership was going to win the military struggle with Chiang Kai-shek, they decided to join the Communist Party of China and function there as supporters of the revolution, but to fight for a democratic regime and to oppose the Stalinist policies. But this, of course, was not accepted by the regime, as it should have been by a genuine revolutionary regime. Here are supporters who are willing to support your socialist aims, even though they may have policy differences on the question, on subsidiary questions, essentially that of the regime, or of the certain policies of the regime. And then in 1951-52, all of the known Trotskyists were arrested in China and have disappeared, were executed, and haven't been heard from since. And there has been a campaign lately for the Maoists to, while they're freeing all the former Kuomintang officials, to also free the Trotskyists. They're still in prison in China, if they're still alive, or what is left of them that are still alive. And there's just simply no information on it.
What is the basis of the Sino-Soviet?
Well, basically, I'm not talking of what how it broke out. It's the divergent interests between two nationalistically inclined bureaucracy that operate on two different worker states. You know, they have two different national and bureaucratic interests. That's the basic difference. Precisely on what issue they broke, you know, there's all kinds of different questions. Some say it was because they disagreed with the communalization policy. Others say it's because Khrushchev refused to furnish nuclear weapons or atomic weapons to the Mao Zedong regime. And probably, you know, all of these factors into it, as well as, you know, the struggle over the frontiers and certain other concessions. But basically, I would say it's the reason that both of these bureaucracies based on worker states are based on two different worker states that have two different national interests, and that's what they function under. If they were internationally or internationalistically oriented towards the world revolution, those differences would be minimized. You know, they would agree on common goals. But as it is now, the Mao regime considers the Soviet bureaucrats a bigger threat than the American imperialists. And they're willing to ally themselves with the Western imperialists against the Soviet Union, which is absolutely incorrect.
Well,
there's a kernel of truth in that, and that's my own personal opinion now. In this sense, that Trotsky based himself and Lenin on the experiences of Russian history. In Russian history, they also had peasant revolutions, except they were all defeated. China had a different history. They were all, not all of them, but you know, eight of them were successful. There was a big different national background. So obviously, there are some elements of differences there in the national history. On the other hand, the peasant revolution that Mao led wasn't really the revolution of the dynastic cycle of China. It just happened to be due to the fortuitous circumstances that I tried to outline, he was able to accede to power without the intervention of the Chinese proletariat, which otherwise would have been absolutely essential under different circumstances. It just happened at that particular historical conjuncture he could do it, which nobody could foresee, you know, all the confluence of all these factors, and you certainly wouldn't want to base a revolutionary strategy on that, because it may never happen again. And those that tried to apply the Maoist strategy in other countries have failed. It didn't apply in that way. So in that sense, Lenin and Trotsky, taking off from the Russian experience, which showed that if a peasantry rises up, and not just the Russian experience, also the experience in Western Europe, in order for a peasant revolution to be successful, even in medieval times, the peasants always had to have support of the city classes, you know, the main administrative and political and industrial centers of the country. That was the classic anti-feudal revolution in Europe. There are some exceptions. I can think of the revolution in Mexico in 1910. Remember the scene where Zapata and Villa sit in Mexico City? They have been victorious. The guerrilla forces are sitting in Mexico City, but it's planting time, and they have to go back to the countryside. You know, their military forces have to go back to the fields and plant. They can't stay in the city. You know, so the Mexican Revolution began to degenerate, and the bourgeoisie took it over and led it to, you know, the country to what it is now. So, from that point of view, except Lenin had the idea that possibly the Russian peasantry could raise up a genuine peasant party with which the Workers' Party could ally itself. He had that schema after 1905, but adjuncted in 1917. And in Russia, it was the working class that allied itself with the peasantry and was able to establish a social regime, which I think is the normative, normal way in which revolutions take place. That's why I call the Chinese Revolution, the third one, a deformed revolution. It's, and, you know, it's not a model of revolution that can be applied to other countries, in my opinion. That's why it shouldn't become a model, and where people have tried to apply it as a model, it hasn't proven to be successful, that the application of it. Yes, right. Well, let me tell you some other bourgeoisies that were not nationalistic. When the Nazis conquered France, you think the French bourgeoisie was nationalistic and fought the Nazis? See, their property rights go before their nationalism. The Nazis safeguarded their property rights in the factories, and they loved the Nazis, and they hated the partisans. They collaborated. That was true in Yugoslavia as well. The Yugoslav bourgeoisie cooperated with the foreign invader that had conquered the country because they safeguarded their property rights. And who was fighting the Nazis? Well, the workers, you see. And naturally, and the workers weren't just fighting the Nazis, but the bourgeoisie that was collaborating with the foreign invaders and imperialists. Chiang Kai-shek refused to fight the Japanese invaders. He would rather fight the communist-led peasant guerrillas. That's why he wasn't nationalist. I mean, a nationalist would support his own guerrillas against the foreigners, right? That's not what Chiang Kai-shek did. He was not nationalist. In action, and everybody knew it, he's a traitor. And they knew it. I'm describing that they weren't nationalists. If they had been nationalists, then there would have been no problem. But the bourgeoisie puts its property rights above any rights of nationalism. They'd rather have the foreigner safeguard their proper rights and shoot down the people that speak their own language. See, their class interests go before any common interests that they supposedly have with their own workers. Yes, yes. I don't know, do you see any? You're talking about how long Taiwan can survive on? I'm sorry, I can't hear. Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, now. You had Taiwan in there, did you? Oh, Saigon, okay. I'm sorry, it's hard to hear. Yes, it's, I should have mentioned that it's a very striking parallel that the policy that the PRG is following is sort of this repetition of the kind of policy that the Maoists followed when they succeeded to power. Coalition government, no overthrow of the capital's proper relations, the private properties to be safeguarded, and so forth and so on, but they obviously are going to be forced to change that policy as the remaining bourgeois forces and landlord forces in South Vietnam begin to regain their confidence. You know, some of them are in Camp Pendleton, you know, they're out of the situation, but a lot of them are left back there. And while the PRG has the military forces right now, it's also true if they give back to the capitalists their economic power, they can very quickly regenerate, you know, some kind of social basis of support and some kind of social weight in the country and begin to reorganize to either overthrow the regime or moderate it in some way. And then the other problem in South Vietnam, which didn't exist in China, except to a certain extent, is to bring the two halves of the country into some kind of consonance. You know, you got North China, North Vietnam, with non-capitalist proper relations, and South Vietnam with capitalist relationships, and they talk about unifying the country. That's a very difficult kind of proposition, unless they want to reintroduce capitalism into North Vietnam. But again, see, they haven't thought it out. They don't know what's ahead. They're operating on the Stalinist schema of the two-step revolution, and they don't know what they're going to have to do until, you know, the counter-revolution, again, is going to force them into doing it.
I just have to say that I appreciate everything you have to say, but there are points I disagree with. And I can't see how you say that now is the art of power is down and down. I think that what was always taken into consideration that you're dealing with a country of some 800 million people. And I don't think anyone here can actually comprehend what that means, especially when it's in a country which is basically $100. I think if you look at what's going on in China today, as compared to the pre-liberation of China, a wide difference in the lives of all the people and peasants. And I know there are things that Mao regime has done, which I don't agree with violence or oppression. But in any government, there are things that happen, which I don't agree with. But if you look at the lives of the people today and 30 years ago, there's a wide difference in terms of workers, peasants, and...
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree, and we support those things. That's not what we're criticizing.
Well, listening to you is like sitting on a Soviet delegation, and it's not a Soviet...
No, we criticize the Soviets just as well.
But it's just like everything you said there, the whole negation of what's going on in China, really producing what you're saying, in terms of the lives of...
I tried to indicate we support the achievements of the revolution, and I haven't spent, you know, the bulk of my talk on that, but on the criticisms that we have, for the good reason, because that's where we differ. And we don't agree on the cult, you know, the Maoist cult and the regime. But we agree on the achievements of the revolution and on the achievements of the non-capitalist property forums. We point to those. I think you were here in the very beginning, I said, we support the social system, but we criticize the regime. That means we support the achievements and the good things that are there, but we criticize the bad things. In other words, we have the proportion there. It may sound like we're all critical, but we're not. We, in action, supported the Chinese regime. In the Korean War, the chairman of the Socialist Workers' Party sent a very hot letter to Truman at the time, and we all expected to be arrested. We engaged in demonstrations and actions then. We supported, you know, China in its aspiration in the dispute over the borders in India, the Sino-Indian border dispute. We support, you know, the revolution in action in this country, you know, when it comes to that. But we have differences and criticisms of the regime, just as we do with the Soviet Union. So we're partisans of the Chinese Revolution. But we realize one fundamental truth that Marx pointed out. Nobody can make a revolution for someone else in a patriarchal fashion. No bureaucrat can come along and make you free despite yourself or for you. It has to be done by the masses themselves. And see, we're speaking in that sense for the aspirations of the Chinese masses against bureaucratic rulers.
That one of Mao's goals during the Cultural Revolution, to try and rid bureaucracy.
But what did he do to the masses and the Red Guards? Not what he said, it's what he did. He sent them to the countryside, into exile. You see, you have to distinguish what these people say, that's demagogy, and what they actually do. Now, you know, for us, this is argued in a vacuum. In China, this is not a vacuum. In China, if you're a Red Guard in the countryside, you're being re-educated in Mao Zedong's thought and having to repeat it every day by rote. This is not just an academic question. You know, are you for that kind of brainwashing? We're not. That's not the way it's done. The difference between mental and physical labor will appear under disappear under socialism when you reach a high enough technological level, not by taking intellectuals and making peasants out of them. That's not the way the difference between mental and physical labor is going to disappear. Although I would agree, it doesn't hurt an intellectual to do some physical labor. You know, I'm not opposed to that. I think it stimulates the brain once in a while to do that. We're not for that. But to do it forcibly and compulsory, that's what we disagree with. To be what kind of a defender?
Better defender.
Yes, we would defend it by revolutionary methods, rather by you know, his demagogy, by his deals with the imperialists, by the various secret arrangements that he makes with the capitalist diplomats and so forth. We certainly wouldn't do it by welcoming the Empress of Iran to Peking in a state banquet. We don't think that's a revolutionary way of defending the interests of the Chinese government, although we have nothing against a workers' government having diplomatic relations with anyone. But when you do that, you don't have to ascribe virtues to them that they do not possess. The Shah and Empress of Iran are not anti-imperialists by any stretch of the imagination. And they imprison revolutionaries in their own country and would expose that even while we would have, if we were in Peking, you know, diplomatic relations with these people. And we certainly wouldn't have welcomed Nixon to Peking while he was bombing the hell out of Hanoi. That we certainly wouldn't have done.
Do you think that I've noticed very much in reading the press, but we can review the 490 press, and that is the Maoist bureaucracy now claims that Liu Tiao was trying to create an elite among the Red Guard students and intellectuals who was actually, and that's why they're suppressing them in the countryside. Why would these people want to be an elite of Liu Tiao when it's his army that smashed them during the Cultural Revolution?
Well, Lin Biao now becomes a scapegoat, you know, for all the bureaucratic excesses. He now, everything is blamed on him. I think I already made the point previously when Shirley Black-Lane was asked, what about Ding Ling, who was put in jail during the aftermath of the Blossom and Contend campaign? She was a famous woman playwright and intellectual in China, who spoke up against the bureaucratic excesses during the 100 flowers bloom period, and then was framed up as a rightist. And the answer that she was given in China was, oh, that was Lin Biao that did that. So everything now is blamed on Lin Biao. Becomes a scapegoat again for things that Mao did.
Yet around the and let them live together without being married until they reach marriage age and get around this oppression of living. Also, they forced old communists who had refused to marry and live together, people who had gone on a long march as a reaction against the state, they forced them to get married under the Marriage Act. And finally, on this question of the thought of Mao Zedong, I don't think that everybody really took it too seriously in China, because I read an English language copy of the Peking Daily, in which in the letters to the editor, and they allow letters to the editor that I did this better because of the thought of Mao, of Chairman Mao and all that, but you mentioned that agriculture was intensive and organic. And by organic, they used human feces, which they call night soil. They collect that and use that. Well, there was a letter to the editors that said, I collected night soil better than anyone else by reading the thoughts of Chairman Mao. So I'm sure that was a tongue-in-cheek thing that the editors did. They weren't really all that gung-ho.
Yes, on the Indonesian debacle, you know, where millions of Communist Party members were killed, the Mao regime supported the policy of the Indonesian Communist Party, led by their General Secretary Aidit, of a coalition with Sukarno, who was, again, one of these progressive nationalists, in quotes, bourgeois, because Sukarno established diplomatic relations with Peking. So for diplomatic reasons, they betrayed the revolution in Indochina and allowed Sukarno, with this bloc with Sukarno, for a counter-revolutionary right-wing coup to occur that slaughtered millions of Indonesian Communist Party members, which is a real betrayal on the part of Peking of a colonial revolution, the support of the colonial bourgeoisie. On the Marriage Act and it's true, you see, again, it's true. They passed the Marriage Act, they made certain progressive changes in the previous institutions of the patriarchal family, but they strictly limited it to their control. They allowed so much freedom and not much more, and then put a line on it. Actually, as far as the liberation of women is concerned and the women's liberation movement, while it's true that objectively the Chinese women were able to achieve a number of steps forward in the Chinese Revolution, it's also true that the Chinese regime is very straight-laced and conventional. They're by no means in favor of any real women's liberation in their thinking. They're essentially conservative bureaucratic mentality. While they pay lip service, and in some ways they may be ahead of the capitalist attitudes towards women, they also have a fairly Philistine attitude, you know, of sexual activities and so forth. I'm sorry, I can't hear a word. Enumerate the evidence. They have hidden emoluments that come with the perquisites of state power. They have limousines. They live in the imperial palace or the biggest houses. They have paid vacation country houses. And they have the finest chefs in China cooking their Chinese meals. with all the delicacies that the emperors used to enjoy at their state banquets and so forth. Whereas the ordinary Chinese doesn't eat that way, or doesn't, perhaps the difference is less in the dress. They don't dress as fancy as the Soviet bureaucrats do. In the dress it is less apparent, but they definitely do have tremendous differences in living standards. In the ordinary Chinese is lucky to ride a bicycle or so on, whereas they have all the cars. There are stories of, in the finest restaurants in Peking, there are fleets of black limousines every night by the state functionaries that eat there. And of course, no ordinary Chinese can enter those kind of restaurants and so forth. And then, of course, they have the state banquets where the upper levels of the state bureaucracy is invited in the Great People's Hall in Peking, where they serve something like 10,000 people in 1 hour and a half. I don't know how they do it, but and it's a very good meal. Except one of the descriptions is that the waiters pass the dishes by so fast that the guests are lucky to get anything. And it might be because the kitchen help is trying to get as much as possible back into the kitchen to eat it themselves. I don't know. It's just a guess. I have eaten in those kind of restaurants. Anyway, there was one description that let that little fact slip out. You have to eat fast there or you don't get anything because it goes by so fast. But there is definitely indication that their standard of living is a typical bureaucratized Also, the catteries have special stores, as they do in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, where they get special goods and so on. I think Liu Shaoqi had a more moderate policy. It was still a Stalinist type policy of peaceful coexistence, but he didn't want to break with the Soviet Union on the level that the Maoists did. In other words, to keep it to the point where it's an inter-fraternal dispute rather than some kind of, that the Soviets are social fascists or something like that, as Mao has called them, that he's willing to ally himself with the American imperialists, you know, against the Soviets. It was a more moderate bureaucratic policy. I wouldn't call it internationalist. You know, it was not quite as sectarian as sectarian on one hand towards the Soviets and opportunistic towards the Americans as Maoists. The question is whether the cult of Mao Zedong comes from the problems of building socialism in an underdeveloped country, or is it just the typical Chinese phenomena that existed from Confucius' time? Well, first of all, you know, we don't believe in building socialism in one country. We don't think it can be done. We think that where the workers or where a socialist revolution has triumphed, it should merely be an outpost for helping to complete the world revolution, that the socialist society should be built on a world scale, that it cannot be built in any particular country. That's why we call ourselves internationalists. No national socialism can be built anywhere. You can build up the productive forces, but that's not socialism. It shouldn't be called socialism. The standard of living of the masses should be improved. But that's different from trying to build socialism in the country by lowering the standard of living of the masses, or by, you know, not raising it as fast as he could if he had the other perspective. That was the central point of the policy dispute between the Stalin and the Trotsky faction about the pace of industrialization in the Soviet Union in the 20s. So we think there is no justification whatsoever for any kind of cult, which is as un-Marxist and unscientific as you can get in an underdeveloped country, because we disagree with the basic economic perspective, you see, of building a socialist society in an underdeveloped country. We don't think it can be done, that that's a utopia, that it has to be built on a world society, world basis. That's why we are for the international world revolution to be completed as fast as possible. And then you can organize things on a world scale. And then you can very quickly bring underdeveloped countries up with the aid of the technologically advanced countries up to the modern technological levels and so forth, which is a different thing. But under no circumstances should a Marxist or a revolutionary agree to build up the cult of some individual. You know, it's totally un-Marxist and unscientific. It appeals to all the prejudices, all the religious attitudes of people that should be fought against and not fostered. Yes, it's true. Stalin cult and the cult of Mao resides back in the dark recesses of class society, where always some individuals was built up as superhuman, some kind of god that had to be worshipped and whose word has to be taken as the holy writ. But that's not science or Marxism or modern. Yeah, well, in each case, they took the wrong position because of their alliance with the bourgeoisie. There are very cases that you enumerated. And I have the feeling of beating a dead horse in that sense. It's just that they took the wrong position, ended up on the counter-revolutionary side for reasons of their diplomatic interests, which doesn't really further the interests of China as a worker state at all. It weakens it, but for their own diplomatic game that they're playing for their own aggrandizement.
And what specifically is the extent of Chinese involvement in Tanzania as far as developing and building a ministry there, and also what extent are they economically involved in that country?
Well, I really don't know that much about it. I'm not an expert on Tanzania. I'm more an expert on internal China. That's why I tried to stay away from the other question.
Can you tell me how it was that North Korea became socialist? Did it come about as a result of the Potsdam Agreement? And also, can you say something about the accounts in the bourgeois press about some military actions maybe taking place between North Vietnam and Cambodia?
I know very little about North Korea, except I've read some of Kim Il-sung's emanations, and if they don't remind me of Stalin or something, nothing ever will. It's just pure Stalinism. The cult of Kim Il-sung, I think they inundate if you get on their mailing list, they'll inundate you with the sayings of Kim Il-sung, and just read them. I think they refute themselves. It's just. And the other question, from what I can see, and I haven't had a definite opinion on it, what's happening in Cambodia seems to be a version of ultra-left adventurism that's even puts Mao to shame, where they are going to abolish the cities and put everybody on the countryside, and given the national orientation of the various regimes, say in North Vietnam and in Cambodia, I wouldn't be surprised that there was some fighting there. But again, it's putting the interests of some very small countries and the national bureaucratic interests of the leadership above the needs of the world revolution. It's simply ridiculous in our eyes to fight over a piece of ground when what should be fought for is the world revolution. And a piece of ground doesn't mean anything. You know, like the Chinese and the Soviets on the Ussuri River fighting over an island in the middle of the river, which is, I mean, you know, to our eyes, it doesn't mean anything. They can leave it unoccupied. To our eyes, the paramount task of this period is the world socialist revolution and whatever you can do to further that, not which plot of ground goes to what little country or big country for that matter.
Do we have time for one last question?
I wonder if you could comment on the difference between the different Taoist Communist parties and the third world that the armed struggle of the Communist Party the
people's army. I'm sorry.
It seems that in the third world there are several types of Maoist movements. There's the armed struggle movements, for example, the Maoists and the people's army movements. And on the other hand, you have groupings like the PKI, which practice Karma. I was wondering, since China doesn't have its communism through which it can control its different national parties, what do you comment on that?
I don't think the Maoist leadership in Peking is really that much concerned about having groups otherwise that make revolutions or anything like that. They're more concerned, you know, with their own country, with having true some supporters or whatever their policy happens to be, than to have, you know, viable groups, unless it is in the interest of the factional struggle with the Moscow bureaucrats. They're not that vitally concerned. When Lenin and Trotsky were in the leadership, you know, the Soviet government and the Soviet Union, they were concerned with building a communist international, forming revolutionary parties. They called congresses of revolutionists to Moscow to hammer out policy and so forth. As far as I know, nothing of that type has been done in Peking. They will have sympathizers come and they will greet foreign heads of state or people of foreign movements, but you know, they're not really concerned with forming some kind of consistent Maoist international or anything like that. The way it looks, their concern and preoccupation doesn't seem to be with that at all. They might give the franchise one day to this little group and then next day to some other group becomes the official group. Then if the policy in Peking changes, some third group will get the franchise. It doesn't seem that important to them. It does to us, but it doesn't seem important to them.
Before everyone leaves, I want to thank everyone for coming and remind you of the campaign committee meeting that the Socialist Workers' Party will be having in the back of the hall right after this ends. It'll be about 5 o'clock.